will be discussing some of the issues that women confront today. One of the things that Janet has worked with a lot is what we call inclusive language. And that is in regard to the Bible and the church's use in our liturgies and so on of language. And so we're going to spend part of our time on that. And then we'll spend part of our time talking about ourselves as much as you wish to. And kind of where you're coming from and what some of your situations have been. This group actually started, I think, Saturday. And a number of people wanted to continue because we had such a good discussion last time. Real open sharing. I think I'll start with this article. There was a conference in Minneapolis. This is dated July 27th, 1982, called the Jeanette Picard Conference. You will remember Jeanette Picard as being a real pioneer in many respects, a balloonist, set world records and so on. But probably the way we remember her best is that she was one of the first ordained women in the Episcopalian Church. I believe she was 80 years old when she did that. There's hope, folks. Mm-hmm. We can still be doing stuff at 80. And so this conference was in her honor and is designed for women in the clergy. One of the women who attended was Elaine Marsh, a pastor who is at a large congregational church in Minneapolis. And she said this about women in the ministry, or in fact about the church. "The church is a male institution," Marsh said. "It is male through and through. God is perceived in male terms. It is, as Catholic theologian Mary Daly says, if God is male, then male is God." And we will be looking at that. "From the time they are little girls, women hear the Trinity referred to as the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost. Marsh says she makes a point of baptizing in the name of God, the Creator, Redeemer, and Sustainer." There we have a different use of language portraying the same message, but taking out one of the loaded terms, so to speak. Well, let's, before we go on with some of this, let's turn to Janet and have her tell us what has been going on here at Holden and some of the stuff that I think is really interesting.
My mode is to give a little bit of an introduction and then to have people ask questions or make comments or share some of their experiences related to this. So I will take a few minutes and then feel free to interrupt me or wait and have with your questions, whichever is most comfortable. But I won't be talking too long. I got started on this a few years ago, I suppose, the whole idea of inclusive language. And I have found that when I use that phrase, a lot of people don't know what that means, inclusive language. I think Judy has explained it. And I hope that many of you understand it to be making our language so that all people feel included by it, men, women, and children. I look at inclusive language as clarifying our language or making it clearer so that we can understand what's being said. It's not so that some of the generic terms that used to stand for all people are still hold the same meaning, such as the word mankind doesn't hold the same meaning it did many years ago for many people. Let me give you one little example of something that may exemplify what I'm talking about, some of the confusion. Using the word man or men, if I said I need a few men to move the pulpit, we probably all would agree that that's a few male people. Not necessarily, but probably if I said I need a few men to move the pulpit, that's what I would mean. If I said all mankind is one brotherhood, at one point I think we could all assume that that means all of us, all men and all women and all children. But if I said God calls men to the ministry, that could mean men who are male, or it could mean all people also. So no longer, for me anyways, does that word include me all the time. I see it as a justice issue, not just as a women's lib kind of thing. Lots of people say, well, it's just an outcropping of the women's lib kind of thing. I do see it as a justice issue, and I don't see that it is comparable to other issues. I think it is alongside of other issues. Some people say, well, there are so many other things that are so much more important. And I guess I think that it is an oppression issue, just as America over Russia in a nuclear arms race is an oppression issue, or black-white is an oppression issue, rich-poor, Lutheran, non-Lutheran, Protestant, Catholic. I see those as all kind of oppressions, and that not one is better or worse than the other. Our liturgy is important to us. I grew up in the Methodist Church, where we didn't have the kind of liturgy that the Lutheran Church does. And now that I'm a part of the Lutheran Church, I've come to enjoy the chanting and the liturgy as it is in the Lutheran Church. And I realize that it's a real important thing for most Lutherans. And I also realize that it can be unjust to some people when they feel excluded from it. Historically, women have been subordinated, and I'm not going to go at length in this. I think we most here are women and maybe know some of that history. In biblical times, women were property. They were for procreation. Didn't really have the same status as men at all. And in fact, when you look at Jesus' behavior, it's really radical, because he first revealed himself to a woman, the Samaritan woman at the well, and his relationship to women, he taught them, they were amongst his closest circle of friends. And in those times, women weren't even spoken to. Here at Holden this past winter, there were some people that brought this issue to the forefront, and we made an agreement as a community to have a work group get together and work on the issue of inclusive language. We met weekly from December until May, and some of those weeks were weeks in which we did some work sessions together. There are a couple women here that were involved in that also. We worked sometimes, we drew up things, we wrote prayers, we wrote new services, we talked about hymns. Lots of times we came together for a study session together. We had Dan Erlander do a session on the Trinity and how do we deal with that Trinity form, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. And where did it come from and why is it so meaningful to us? We spent some time with the Lord's Prayer. So we spent many weeks talking and dialoguing and going back and forth about why do we have this language and what does it mean to us. Taking one word and talking about it for a long time. We spent about an hour one evening talking about the word Lord and what that means to us, with a capital L and with a small L. As a result of many weeks of conversation and dialogue and frustration, put tears and happiness, and there were all those things. We came up with a new matin service that we have an alternate form for the matin service, the morning prayer service that is in the Lutheran Book of Worship. We will be using that this Sunday morning. Part of the one thing that we came up with as this group is that we would offer this as an option during the summer community. So every third week we offer this alternate matin service, and then another week we do the matin service that is in the book printed. We do it as it is printed in the Lutheran Book of Worship. And then the third week we do the responsive prayer as printed in the Lutheran Book of Worship. So that there's a variety of options as far as language is concerned. You'll notice that on the tables we have several graces that we use. One of those graces was written by one of the community members this winter to include a female image of God. One of the things I have learned in the last year or so, that there are lots of feminine images for God in the Bible, and that I had never been aware of those until the last couple of years, and I wondered why, and why don't we use those? God is a much broader thing than just a male pronoun or a male image that I think we will all agree that God is not is a sexless person, sexless being. I don't even know if God's a being, but is sexless. And so why? My question then is, why do we use tunnel vision and only use male pronouns and male words for God? Why don't we use as many images as we can and broaden our imagery? So you'll notice that one of the prayers that we've included in on the grace sheet is, does have a very feminine image imagery in it. The Vespers that we did last evening, the theme Vespers was written to be inclusive. It wasn't written as solely an inclusive Vespers. It's a theme Vespers, but it is also inclusive. And we have some guidelines drawn up for people who lead worship or for people who come to the village and who are interested in this issue. I have some copies of this here, several copies of it. If you'd like to take one today, do so. There are others on the bulletin board at the west end of the dining hall. Feel free to take that one of these if you'd like. We just have called it guideline, language guidelines, and it is for people leading worship at Holden. And it's not, they aren't rules. We aren't saying you have to do this. We're asking you that you consider it and try it once in a while so that we can, as a community, broaden our images and our language. One of the other things that has just come out, it's just hot off the press. Dan Erlander, I don't know, many of you, is our Resource Center Director, and one of his projects is to develop a resource packet. And his first resource packet will be coming out in the next few days. It's just being printed. But there's one page in it that is going to be devoted to inclusive language, and there are some resources on this that we have pulled together. And if you'd like a copy of this, Dan doesn't have any qualms with people taking it before it's out to the people who have made subscriptions. So if you'd like one of these, you can grab one of those for me. Another thing I have up here is a list of the alternate titles for the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost. And as we were sitting around one evening, we said, okay, let's just write down anything that comes to mind that we could call God in a prayer or in a service, and we just brainstorm. When you brainstorm, you don't edit. You write down everything. So it gets kind of bizarre sometimes, but we wrote down everything we could think of. I think the most wild one is Holy Smoke, but we don't use that one very often.
Why don't you give some of the...
But some of the ones that are used more frequently are God of Equity, Creator, Yahweh, Sanctifier, Advocate, Comforter, Nurturer, Almighty, Merciful One. Most of these were taken from the Psalms. We just opened the Bible and started going through the Psalms and pulled out lots of different... And I was amazed at the different things that come out of there, and it just broadens who God is for me. So these are available too. I have some... So we're in process. I don't think, I'm in process, I speak for myself. I don't think that, sometimes I get real angry and I want to be done with this, I want it to be the way I want it to be, but I know that it's all a process and that I will change, that others will change, that things will go back and forth. But I think it's important for me to keep the idea of broadening who God is and just... being allowing myself to be open to the greater images of who God is. Let me read to you the minutes or some notes taken at December 7th, 1981 meeting, our first meeting of the people that got together here. And this is the initial consensus regarding a language criteria that we came to in that group, the very first time we came together. The people of God should be addressed inclusively always. God should be addressed with diverse images, neither exclusively male nor female, but not neuter. Liturgy is a cultural expression of worship, and some freedom to paraphrase is possible to be inclusive. Ongoing tension of being inclusive with Scripture is written in a patriarchal society exists within our group. And if negative images of women exist in Scripture, the burden of interpretation is on the person doing the preaching for a particular Vespers or Eucharist or whatever service it might be. So basically, the two main things that we worked on from that were that the people of God should be addressed inclusively, and that God should be addressed with a variety of images, including male, female, but not neutered. So I guess from there, I have some books and things I'd like to point out to you, but maybe we should talk some first, and then I can point out some of these books that are, some are available in the bookstore, some I have found particularly helpful, and things I've done. So maybe people have reactions or comments or things that you've experienced or whatever. Maybe Linda and Sue have some comments.
What is a neuter? What do you mean by neuter?
To call God it. I would, and we as a group agreed that we didn't want to do that. But we didn't want to call God exclusively she or he.
I guess I have some problem understanding why the masculine image is such a problem to people when it doesn't change who God is by what we call him.
For me, the masculine image isn't a problem at all. But it does change my image of who God is when I realize that God has feminine traits too, feminine images for him. I didn't know that until 2 or 3 years ago, that some of those were in the Bible. And that I have really, I feel like I've grown in my knowledge of who God and understanding of who God is.
Could you give some examples of what those
feminine images? Well, I can't give the verses. Maybe Judy can. She's in seminary. But there's one image of, I mean, that counts, right? That's awful. I didn't say that. There's one imagery where God is compared to a midwife many times, midwifery. Also, a God as a mother hen, nurturing the brood, bringing the brood to under the wings of the mother hen.
There's one that says clutching the world to his bosom or her bosom or something like that. More of a female.
And in another image of God in agony as a woman in travail, labor, giving birth, mother creating, giving, the birthing image is really important, I think.
There's one about suckling child. There's the parable of the lost coin. God is portrayed as a woman looking for the coin. The Greek word, where did I get this? It's often translated God became man and dwelt among us, but the Greek word is the word for flesh and human rather than just
anthropos. Anthropos is the word you're referring to, right? Anthropos?
Yes.
And that word is not a feminine or masculine word.
In fact, the Hebrew doesn't identify male, female in terms of God either, because they have a word that includes both, and we don't have a word like that. So from the very start, it wasn't intended to be only male, but it was a patriarchal society.
God created man in his own image, male and female, he created them. So female is in the image of God also. Yeah.
Linda, did you have some more?
Well, it's just a list of them that I got from Christine Carlson, so it's a bunch of Bible references.
Oh, yeah.
Well, yeah. A lot of Psalms, like Psalm 131 says, but I have smoothed and still myself as a weaned child upon its mother's bosom. That's like the psalmist as a child who is already weaned, needing to go back to God for sustenance. And it specifically says mother. And there's lots more.
I guess for me, the images of a male God being a nurturing God has helped in the struggle that I've had about being, not necessarily being the only nurturer in the family.
There was a period of time when my husband was not working, and I was. And he was the primary nurturer for our children at that period of time. And that was very contradictory to the lifestyle and the conservative farm background that we had come from. And it was a real struggle. And I don't know that we dealt with it very well at that time, but over the years, it's helped me to think of a male God being a nurturer, to allow males to also be nurturers, or to take away that inclusive responsibility for me. And so then I have a struggle when you turn those, you know, you start turning those into female images, because I've already settled where I was at with them, and I don't know if I want to do it again.
I don't think that men aren't nurtured by any means. Can't be, I mean, as many men are. I think that that in our culture, you know, lots of attributes have been given to, assigned to women and to men, and that it sounds like you worked it through the other way around, and a lot of people have.
Well, I'm just saying, you know, that's sort of clear.
I think this also opens up for men. I think for men it just gives them so much freedom to be able to, you know, open themselves to those kinds of attributes also.
How many of you have ever had, can remember in childhood or at any time, wondering about that word man, capital M? It would. I don't know when your first awareness would be, what that meant, and who you asked. Do you remember that at all? When you began to run across man with a capital M and wondered what that meant. Linda?
Well, I remember when I was writing papers in high school and coming upon and trying to find a non-awkward way to say, instead of every time I wanted to say, if a person wanted to do something, he would, and saying he or she and that kind of thing. And I'd write one using he or she, and I'd get the paper back and I'd say, awkward, use he, and that kind of thing. And I was just reading, I'm using sort of another subject book. I was reading Thomas Merton the other day, and I really like Thomas Merton a lot, but he always says, man, 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 he, and I was reading along, you know, telling myself every time, this man, he, so he uses man through 200 pages, and all of a sudden I came to this one entry that says, one of man's biggest problems is his relationship with woman, and all of a sudden I went, just a minute, does that mean all those 200 pages before did not mean people, it meant man? Like he didn't even care if we ever read anything he'd wrote, you know, that kind of thing. It's like double standard kind of stuff, and that really shows to me how inaccurate it is to call people men. And why can't you just say people? To me it doesn't, anyway, that's my beef.
There was a push at one time to have a new pronoun. I think it was the and him, you know, like the
him.
Teach. Yeah.
It was one of them.
Yeah. Well, I think I saw it done V-E and V-I-M and so on to make the present and past and so on. It didn't go very far. One of my classmates in college tried to write a thesis that way. It didn't make it.
I think one important consideration is the young child who doesn't read and can't see capital M in front of man and doesn't understand what we're talking about when we talk about mankind or humankind, because they can hardly keep track of their whole family. And that child hearing all the time only the masculine references does, I think, automatically begin to exclude, if it's a girl, exclude herself without knowing that she's included. And she can't know that unless, for some reason, someone sits down and explains it to her.
I belong to this large church and am a good friend with a young family. They have the most darling little girl you've ever seen. She was 4 or 5 at the time that this happened. And I guess she was 4. And she sang her prayers. And in that church that morning, we had a guest preacher, who I think is here, a woman from Stillwater. And when at bedtime, Colleen was blessing everybody, you know. Bless Pastor Peterson, and bless so-and-so, and bless so-and-so. And then her mom, who's been working outside the home as well as in the home, and is really a very dynamic woman, talked with her about pastors. And finally she said to Colleen, you know, you could be a pastor, Colleen. Oh no, Colleen said, only boys can be pastors. And she had heard the sermon that very morning from a woman. So things don't connect as quickly as we might assume they do. But she had watched that process a long time, and that was her observation, even coming from, quote, a liberated home. I'm also sensitive to the fact that some people don't have very loving fathers. And if we limit God to being father, and if loving father doesn't fit, then we do, and I can speak from my own experience, we limit for some people the experience of God. It's real hard to believe in God if you haven't had a loving father, if that's all that God has been represented as.
Or loving male in terms of like young girls and for women. If you can only think of God in a male term, and you haven't had that many nice experiences with males, you know, or a woman who was raped or battered or anything.
Or a child. Yeah. What do you think about Elaine's strong statement? Let's see now. She did her master's thesis on these things. Her master's thesis was on women in the church. It's really a horror story, and the only bright spot in it is Jesus, she said. The church fathers are just replete with the most awful statements about women. They equate women with evil, with the devil, casting them as the bringers of sin, as in the story of Eve tempting Adam with the apple. How many of you have always thought that Eve was Eve's fault? Any? See. It's quite ordinary response. Church literature is shot through with that notion, so you couldn't have women administering the Eucharist because they contaminate the whole thing. Many women pastors feel isolated because they have no female counterparts within miles of them. And this gave, they're talking about the conference, giving women a chance to get together, which they did enjoy very greatly. The statement that kind of got a reaction was, the church is a male institution. It is male through and through. God is perceived in male terms. It is as if God is male, then male is God. That's an interesting turn of words. Either you'd rather be sharing from your own personal stories or you don't have too many opinions on this today.
It was interesting. A couple of years ago, another woman and I decided to break into the all-male area of being ushers in our church. And we decided to do it very... Well, in a very limited kind of way, we chose to usher with our husbands as couples. We weren't coming in and saying, you know, we want all women ushers, but we wanted to be able to greet people. We don't have greeters in our church, and the ushers are greeters too. And we wanted to be able to greet people in the church as a couple. Well, they decided to allow us to do it at the 8 o'clock service, which in our church is the second-class citizen service. The choir never sings at 8 o'clock.
if a guest preacher doesn't have enough time to preach three sermons, he preaches at 9:30 and 11. If you're going to do a musical, you do it at 9:30 and 11. So those of us who attend 8 o'clock on a regular basis are second-class citizens anyway, so it was okay for us to usher for 8 o'clock service. Well, my friend did it first, and I decided rather than to leave her out there in the lurch alone, I would volunteer to do it the next month. She did it one more month in the year. Not only have I not been asked to do it again, my husband is only asked to usher on very rare and special occasions like Christmas when they can't get anybody else to do it.
We, our women, began ushering just some and in a very low-key manner and no big deal. And it took, we just sort of observed that it took about 2 years before the woman got to carry the plates up at after the collection.
Well, we got to do that first, but I was told I didn't know how to do it.
I did it wrong the first Sunday.
The other side to that is, if men want to help in the kitchen at the LCW dinner, then they better be able to do so. Because there are those territories that we claim for ourselves, too. And we have to be conscious of how we perpetuate the system ourselves. First, this one, and then Amy, yeah.
I guess my feeling, too, is that we have to, you know, continue to educate ourselves and even, you know, the women themselves and, you know, in gentle and, you know, but getting it in. My own experience was that I could serve on church and council and I could be vice president of my congregation. But a male that I had served with a number of times had told me later that when my name came up, when I would have, you know, been my turn to be president in a sense, I couldn't be that because at least one of the women had said, you know, well, we can't have a woman as president of the congregation. And so many times I think it's women themselves who are having a great deal of difficulty. At that point, it didn't make a whole lot of difference to me because I had, you know, a bigger job anyway that I was taking on. And, you know, I was involved with the church anyway. But that kind of attitude from women themselves is something that just takes time. And we've only had one woman deacon, and that was about 5 years ago. And for various and sundry reasons, these people happened to leave our congregation and there hasn't been another woman deacon yet. You know, but she was very circumspect. I mean, she just, you know, was very careful about what she wore. I mean, almost to the point of mid-calf skirts and, you know, buttoned up to the neck. I mean, you wouldn't, I mean, it was really kind of amazing.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to make a comment, getting back to the inclusive language thing here. What I hear you saying, I haven't had a chance to look at what you printed there, but it sounds like it's a little more judicious advocacy of change. Last year, we had some topics, comments on it, and I can't remember the name of the book, but there are a number of books that were here where they were talking about really changing the names for God and going to Holy Mother, you know, and going really strong in the other way, pendulum swinging very far. And I was very uncomfortable with some of that because I didn't find a lot of biblical support for that far a swing. And so I sort of wanted to take a little closer look at what you've got, but it looks to me like it's a little more judicious.
Mother is also on this list.
What was that?
Mother is also on this list.
Yeah, but as you said, you know, as sort of alternatives, but it seemed to me that when we first started talking about the way we talk about God and perhaps making some changes, that there were some very, very extreme ideas. And anytime we bring change, especially into the church and especially into the conservative church, I'm not sure if it's better to just go whole hog and just cut right straight through, or if it's better to just, you know, use it judiciously and with a little thought. And I sort of support that.
I suspect both help.
I think both have to exist. I have a response to that, kind of in relationship to what Amy was saying. Christine Carlson was here earlier in the summer. She has done a lot of things with women in the ministry and has been working with Jim Sifkus at ALC headquarters on a women in ministry probe, and has done a lot of different kinds of things. She and another friend of mine and myself have often received feedback saying, you do it in such a gentle manner. It's easy to hear it. I can understand it. I'm more willing to listen to you. But, and that, I always take that kind of compliment. I don't know how to take it. In one sense, it feels real good because people are able to hear what I'm saying. In the other sense is I know a lot of women who really hurt and who are bitter and angry. And I've learned because of them. I've gotten to the place where I am because of them. There are some women here this winter who have been really hurt along the way and were very adamant about changing things. And I wouldn't be at a place where I'm at if it hadn't been for them. So I feel really caught with that. I think, like you're saying, you have to have both. I guess I want to honor that those people, too. I don't want to.
I think what I hear from this the angry women is that we, as people of God and people who live healthy, normal lives, who live in a monogamous relationship where we have children, to see this angry woman and to discuss that angry woman with our spouse, we say, why can't that be a healthy person who is expressing themselves? Healthy in my terms of monogamous within a family situation. But we find women who are angry at men in general. And if we took a real cross-section of it, their anger is not just isolated at the church. They're angry at all men, and they're very castrating. And we try to change that in terms of the men that live within the church community. And they just say, I don't want to listen to her. She's way off.
I wouldn't make that generalization at all. I know many women who are very angry in monogamous families and share that anger. Their husbands share that anger.
Okay. But from a lot of the things that I'm reading, reading and seeing women speaking out, that they are angry, and they're angry generally at men and, you know, cross-section, and they happen to be women in the church.
I also would say that I don't think anger is unhealthy. I think it's very healthy.
I guess I would say, too, that the more I sit on the edge of this thing and start in the seminary and the whole thing, the more I can see that the church is one of the most male institutions I've ever encountered.
Real.
No, I know.
You know, one of the comments that was made to me during this ushering experience and some other kinds of things were, we've said, why can't women council persons serve the Eucharist, men council persons help serve the Eucharist? Why can't women council persons be read the parts of the liturgy or read the gospel or the lessons? Men do it occasionally in our church. And one of our pastors just very adamantly says, and he's the one who frowned at me the hardest when I ushered, said that if we allow women to get into those areas where men have exclusively worked, pretty soon women will take over the whole church and there'll be no men in the church. And he believed, I mean, I've sat down and talked with him about this. This is a man I dearly love. He is my, we have three pastors in our church, and he is my pastor. He is the one that I would choose to go to for anything. But I have this real struggle with him over this issue of, you know, I don't mind working in the kitchen once in a while, but I don't want to go to Project Day and make quilts. And I don't, you know, I'd much rather usher or serve Eucharist or read the liturgy or something like that. I'm not particularly a good cook and I'm a rotten quilt maker. And I don't want to do it.
Not all churches are that way. I belong to a small church. It's a mission congregation. And as far as I know, since it was formed about 6 years ago, families usher. And the children usher, and the women usher, and the men usher, and it's absolutely no big deal. And we all read. Children read, and women read, and men read. So not all congregations are that way. There is, in our congregation, the inequity, the biggest one, is that on the council, the heads of all the various boards and organizations are members of the council, except the president of the ALCW is the only non-voting member on the council. All the other heads are voting members.
Yeah, I'm not at all saying, you know, I'm from a very large conservative church, and, you know, I'm not saying at all that all churches are like that. I just know that that's the experience that we've had, and I don't think that the other women and I that have tried to make, you know, little bitsy changes in this have gone in a way to try and anger people, and we didn't do it to, you know, start any whole new revolution or anything like that. We just wanted.
I too volunteered to usher, and two things happened. I was asked to teach Sunday school, and the head usher offered to come out to my house and give me private lessons in how to usher, with a leer and a laugh and all of that. But isn't that the way that sort of thing happens? I never have ushered. Is it the people who head up the ushering committees or the pastors that prevent? You know, it seems to me that, I don't know, there's one or two individuals blocking whatever we want to do. If we can learn to work, you know, if we hit a closed door on that avenue, we try another avenue until we find receptive people.
Well, you know, I don't know what in my church, it's definitely the pastors who are opposed to. I mean, they've said that to me. They've told me flat out they don't like it. They don't want me to do it again.
So you've had to make the choice whether progress in that area was more important to you than being a member of that church. You've obviously decided to.
Well, I've decided that I'm letting them cool off for a year. This fall, when we get to volunteer for what we want to do again, guess what's going on my sheet?
I think it's really important that before we start to think, boy, my church is really pretty liberal and that there are women involved in all kinds of areas, it's really important to make sure that isn't tokenism. Because I think that there are still, if you go a little beyond, go down to the crux of the whole church and see where your board, who your board members are, and see how many are women, and see who votes, who makes the real decisions, that's where you're going to find out what's really going on in your church. I think there's a lot of tokenism still going on, where, oh, isn't it wonderful that we can have women and doing liturgies and doing the ushering, and then they pat themselves on the back because they're really involved, getting women involved, and I still see a lot of patronization and tokenism. So check with your, you know, in the core of your church and see what's really going on.
I would agree with the idea of tokenism, and yet at the same time, there are times when maybe you settle for a certain amount of tokenism because it gets your foot in the door.
Right.
I mean, I find that from my own perspective. I'm the dean of my conference, and in the NPD, the only woman and only one of three lay people. And I had a pastor just within this last year say something about, oh, you were Solberg's token woman, you know. Well, maybe I was at the beginning, but it was one of those things that just kind of came about. But yet I was elected for the second term, so this time I know I'm in there because of maybe my work. But you do have to do your homework. You can't go off half cocked.
Oh, back here.
This spring I had the opportunity to attend the Lutheran Women's Caucus. Lutheran Intersynodical Women happened to be held at Dana College, and it's held every other year.
Yes.
If you want to join.
And I think that there was something so hopeful that it was my initial experience. I haven't belonged to a local chapter. I will now. But that is that 2 years ago, the Lutheran Women's Caucus made a resolution about the new merged ALC, LCA. that there was going to be a committee of 70 that would be the guiding group to shape our new church, to make decisions about organizations and divisions and such. And it was proposed at that time that 40 of them be men and 40 of them be women, and that the remainder be other minority groups. And that was sent to all of the bishops in those two synods, and that happened. And I think that we, you know, there's ways we can do something about tokenism or powerlessness, or and I think that, you know, I only speaking from a theological basis, I think that there are things to do. And I do have a few limited materials from the Lutheran Women's Caucus that I'd be glad to share, their newsletter, a few copies of it and such.
Great. I have some too. Great. I like your comment about powerlessness. A lot of that starts from inside us. And that's a hard battle. That's a real hard thing to get over. The sense that I cannot change anything, or that I am in fact powerless. Catch yourself in it. We recommended last time the books Cinderella Complex, which is a story of a real woman and how she saw herself move from a very independent and capable woman to being very dependent, and didn't understand what was happening to her, and discovered that and made some conclusions about the fact that many of us do have a dependent image of ourselves and do think that we need a man in order to survive, and that is the way it is. And actually perpetuate that ourselves. But that's in a more of a story form. The book that I have read and liked was Kiss Sleeping Beauty Goodbye. A book, if you're really just starting, but you have to be willing to look at this, would be, there's some anger in this one, I think. It was Women's Reality, but it's real easy to read. You just might have to temper it a little bit because it might go farther than you would go. But any book like that you read, just, you know, it just gives you a chance to look at something for a while and see if it fits. Maybe it doesn't. All these things are up in the bookstore. Linda?
Yeah, I have a comment on the woman that was talking about angry women. And it sort of ties in with Janet saying that anger isn't always bad. But I think there are different kinds of anger, and I get a little angry when I hear comments like that, because that kind of, you know, not normal monogamous married relationship or whatever, because that always triggers in my mind the picture of angry woman as, well, she couldn't get a man, or somebody's hurt her, or something like that. And I see it very much as a justice issue too. And I think there is a lot of good anger going on about injustice all over the world. Anger about people who shouldn't be hungry and are, and anger about people who are being put in prison for their faith, and anger that's very good. And also, it reminds me of a comment that someone made in a forum a couple months ago. He said something about how, why, when there are so many other things the church could be doing, why are people stirring this up and making women be upset about what their roles are? And the response from a man was, how can you say we are stirring this up when it already exists? It's something that exists, and whether or not you have experienced that, we have. And there are a lot of angry women out there, and as Christians, as people who are here to heal other people, if we don't deal with people who are hurting because we don't think their hurt is important, then we are judging whether or not, it's like we are judging what is worth more, which person's hurt is more important than another person's, and that really makes me angry.
I guess if we want to get into all these areas, we better be sure we are as well qualified to fulfill the job that we want. I think I've seen a couple instances where, because women want to get into these areas, they put, quote, token women in who do more damage than good, because they are not as qualified as the male who had that job. And I guess what I'm trying to say is that it's up to us then to get ourselves qualified. If it's a job that we don't have experience in and we want to get in that area, we are going to wreck it for everyone if we put somebody in there
because she's a woman.
Or to support the women who do have.
Right. So if we can get one capable person rather than 10 in there, I think it'd be a lot better for us as a start.
As long as you don't have to be super capable.
No, you should say that. As the person that we want.
I think that, again, is the support thing. If there is a woman, one woman instead of 10 who is capable, the rest of us need to support that woman because she must be very lonely there.
About the anger again, I see that with the way women get angry in the church and the way women get angry at men, it makes women run from the church.
Makes
them run from the church. I mean, they leave it. And I've seen that happen with a lot of my friends who have been real angry at the way things have been, and then they've been brought up with this image of God being very male, and so they've run away from that to other things because they feel like there's no place for women in that.
And that, yeah, that's an unhealthy way to deal with anger, is to
that's
avoid
from it, right? But I think it's very healthy to be angry and to continue to stay there and fight. It reminds me of a comment that a woman made to me, who said, "Well, I think that it's very hard to be a Christian woman and be single." And she said this. She goes, it just must be terribly hard. I feel like Christian women should be married because then they won't be, you know, worried about people trying to, do you know what I'm saying? They wouldn't have to deal with dating and men and sexuality and these other things. That way they'd just be in this monogamous relationship and it would just be like it was very traditional. And she was saying this in church, that she thought that that's how churches should be, that single women should get married.
She's got that figure out.
We just haven't found any.
With regard to the capabilities of women who are asked to serve in the church, sometimes you can get caught up in a situation that I found myself in when I was asked to serve on church building study committee. And I was one woman among a committee of 12. And I was only asked to serve on it, not in a specific capacity. And the first thing that happened at the first meeting was, now who's going to be the secretary? And 11 kids all reported. And I said, no, I can't even type, you guys. I mean, I really don't type. And it was I was a secretary. And I struggled so hard with that, with the hunt and peck method, trying to do the minutes of those meetings. Now, that was 20 years ago, and needless to say, today I would tell them to forget it.
That's progress.
But I did accept the job at that time, much against my will. And I discovered that really the whole intention of asking a woman to even serve was the assumption that she could type, I guess, or could take notes and would be the secretary. Which reminds me also of an excellent picture I saw of Golda Meir once, and the caption underneath that was, "But can she type?"
And I think, you know, what happens sometimes is that when we, the way we're talking right now, I think is okay. And I know that sometimes it causes people to back away a little bit and say, "Oh, it's getting a little angry. It's getting a little resentful." You bet. And those are some of the feelings that some of us have. And managing those is always hard. I think we have to be honest about how we really feel about various kinds of things and be more aware. We were laughing the other day, Nancy and I, about how we both introduced somebody and said, "This is Sue, and her husband does thus." So we all fall into these things where we're not as aware as we need to be. And the other side to it is we must be aware that then we must give men freedom to be different than what they are as well. And we too fall into that trap of thinking they're the ones who ought to be on the property committee, and it's too heavy for us to carry. And it kind of goes both sides. I do think we have to start supporting each other, though. It's taken me a long time to figure out that my best friends are women. They are the people who really take care of me. And I was a long time figuring that out. And if we nurture each other, I think we would all grow.
I'm feeling that the pressure of having dinner now, but I'm back at the same place I was last Saturday, wondering if we want to continue and have one more session. I'm not sure this is a good place to quit. How many would like to do this again? And that's enough. I don't know where we'll fit it in, but we'll. And that time we will again. Maybe we won't focus as much on the church this time, but we'll focus just on our own lives and some of our own struggles. I'll read one. We change slowly, Lord. At times we change almost imperceptibly, and we resist change subtly. But I feel a resistance against me. Men expect me to prove myself, not to miss work. Oh, this is called Mom Has a Second Job. Not to miss work, they sometimes do, to show I can achieve, to maintain both jobs in superior form, to accept lower pay because I'm predicted to be less faithful, less dependable. If I hold back, I'm a dependent female. If I suggest a change, I'm too aggressive. I get mad. I'm a person. I work hard. I'm not all women. I'm me. I look for a day when we see that different individuals can contribute to all areas. An organized man can manage household tasks. And a logical woman can balance books. A sensitive man can work in personnel or childcare. A kind and capable woman can manage a group of workers or a hospital section. I look for a time when we are all encouraged rather than measured or judged. There is neither Jew nor Greek, slave nor free, male nor female. Give me patience without overcompensation and help me take away my own biases.